Welcome to the Leadership Window podcast with Dr. Patrick Jinks. Each week through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is an LSI certified leadership coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and a professional speaker. And now, here's Dr. Patrick Jinks.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 90. Boy, we're just 10 episodes away from the number 100 on the Leadership Window podcast. We are currently, by the way, ranked number 6 on the global ranking site FeedSpot. FeedSpot is the world's largest human-curated database of blogs and podcasts, and they rate by genre. So in the nonprofit leadership space, we are still there at number 6, so I really appreciate all of you for listening and staying tuned, and we're getting several thousand listens per week, which is great in our space, and it's growing, so we appreciate it. We also appreciate Leadership Systems Incorporated for being such a longtime sponsor of the program, and go to leadershipsystems.com to learn more about them. That's where I got my first coaching certification and my training, my deep training in leadership and executive coaching. And if you are interested in learning more about how to add a coaching tool to your toolkit, even inside your company, not necessarily for the purpose of being a professional coach, but if you want to add coaching to your management repertoire, boy, I can't think of a better place to learn it than Leadership Systems. And they are doing a 2-day virtual training periodically throughout the year. So check that out. The pricing is, it's unbelievable value. Dr. Jim Smith is a 30-year coach and trainer at the Center for Creative Leadership. He's a board certified coach and just an extraordinary, about the best I know and have seen. And, continues to kind of serve as my coach here and there informally, and which I really appreciate. But leadershipsystems.com is their site. And again, we appreciate their support. Our site is jinxperspective.com, J-I-N-K-S, perspective.com. And hope if you haven't already, check us out and see what we're doing. We're doing everything we do through the coaching lens. And what that means is that we come to you in mostly nonprofits space. We come to you with more questions than answers. And the idea is to facilitate a conversation where we're asking the right questions. Interestingly enough, when we're doing this on our own, we tend to not pause and just ask some of the really simple but deep questions. And that's what coaching is all about. And I know our guest can relate to that. I'm really excited about this conversation. It's Mark Slabaugh. He is an executive coach. And I love, you know, we've caught up just briefly and met each other. But what I've seen from his material is that he's got unique experience helping nonprofits and churches, by the way, but nonprofit organizations as well, helping their teams pursue what he calls their crazy goals. And I love that because that speaks my language. And the other thing is that I know that one of his objectives is to help nonprofits achieve greater speed. You know, let's create greater impact at faster speed. If there's a specialty, it's probably in the area of fundraising, and we're going to talk some about that. And boy, that has great mission impact. So we've got to do that, and we've got to do it well. And it's one of the toughest things that there is to do in the nonprofit world. And so I can't wait to learn more about how he's helping these nonprofits pursue crazy goals and move at greater speeds. But let me just, with no further ado, let me say welcome, Mark Slabaugh. Thank you for carving out space for us. I've been excited about this conversation.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Patrick. I'm thrilled to be here, and congratulations on the success of this Leadership Window here, 90 episodes in, and man, you're seeing some great success. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's due exclusively, really, to great content. And so it's people like you that have helped make this possible. So again, my thanks to you for being a part of this. This is it's a podcast about leadership, but it happens to be through a social sector lens. So, yeah. You know, our world is in that sector, and we've had people on that aren't necessarily in the social sector at all or very little, but in some areas, leadership is leadership. And so we've had, yes. You know, John Maxwell coaches and Emmy award-winning filmmakers and angel investors and you name it, just talking about leadership. But I like for the majority of the show and the episodes to focus on things that are unique to the nonprofit sector. There are nuances and unique challenges and opportunities. And so I know you're in that space. And so this is great content. I gave you a short introduction. So my first question for you is just going to be, tell us more. Tell us more about yourself. How did you get to this place? Who's Mark Slayball? What is Slayball Coaching and what's your organization and what you're doing?
Yeah, thanks. I began kind of in this church nonprofit space, really with a heart for teenagers. And so I was an ordained minister, was a youth pastor at a local church, and really enjoyed that work and progressed through some other positions within local churches and got to a place where I really began to examine kind of how I worked and the things that I liked to do in my work. And it opened my eyes a little bit to some other possibilities. And so I got into the space of essentially fundraising, helping churches and nonprofits raise money to chase these crazy dreams that they have to make a great impact. And I think one of my convictions about nonprofits and churches is that these leaders are in this space because their heart beats fast for something that is important to them, something that they want to solve, something that they want to give their lives to. And in many ways, as I look at that pursuit, I'm saying, if it's worth doing that, then it's worth funding. So let's get everything together in a great way so that people can give resources to that, because more money equals more mission. And that's really what I try to do in coming behind churches and nonprofits, is just helping them create impact and lean into that funding side. That's really where my expertise is.
Okay. So right off the bat, I just want to pause and tell our listeners, listen close through the rest of this episode, because when you find someone who is, first of all, passionate about fundraising, you've got someone to listen to. You said one thing that really resonated with me that I think is key to all of this, as far as I'm concerned. You said so that people can invest. Mm-hmm. Like this is a gift for them. You're giving them an opportunity to do something big in the world. And that's a mindset on fundraising that not enough people take. We think of, you know, if I can get you to give, mm-hmm. but no, I'm going to open the door and I'm going to let you get, like, this is for you as much as it is for us. That really resonated. I like that. It's not many people that have a passion for fundraising. You know, there's mm-hmm. people that can get coordinated and organized and maybe they're even good salespeople, so to speak. They can tell a story, but the fundraising, just the term fundraising just goes, I mean, it brings bored energy down, like, oh man, fundraising. I don't know if I want to ask this question right off the bat, but I will tell you, I'm interested throughout the conversation about how do you create and foster that kind of just that energy, just that mindset of not dreading fundraising, but seeing it as a great opportunity to engage people in the mission?
Yeah. And really, I mean, the nuance of fundraising is something that I very quickly try to jump out of when I start working with a nonprofit, because of what you just described, the history of fundraising, the mental kind of connotation I have in my brain about fundraising comes into play as soon as you mention the word. Mm-hmm. And so from a functional perspective, nonprofits, you understand you have to do it. When we're talking to our audience, we would bring in different headlines, different titles, different names to what we're trying to accomplish, because those names, those initiatives, that effort should reflect what you're trying to do. It should cast vision, and that vision is not fundraising. That vision is to help people or to solve a problem or to, you know, advance this cause. And so very quickly in working with a leadership team, we're going to bring language and communication, real estate that brings different energy and connotation than fundraising. And so that's what I would say is, that's one of the first things we're going to do is we are going to claim the naming rights of what this effort is.
Absolutely. I love it. I love it. We're not asking people to come to our fundraiser.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that. I actually, my bent for a long time has been, I just don't even like the term fundraising. I like, right. I get it. We're raising funds. We're generating funds. Resource development, you know, years ago became sort of a replacement for that a little bit. But even that, everybody knows what that is, right? That's fundraising. And the word donate, you know, we want to find donors. Yeah. And we've worked, this is, I think United Way did a number of United Ways across the country did a good job of, not all, but many have done a good job on shifting that language to investor, at least to say, we're not asking you to donate to us. That's a gift that you give and forget, and you have no idea what happens. But when you're investing with us, we're literally selling product. If it's a solution to affordable housing, or it's elevating an early childhood system in our community that gets more kids ready for kindergarten, that's a product that you as a business owner or a neighbor or anything should care about. And so you get, to use your term, you get to invest in that, not will you donate money to this because we're a child care center that needs money.
Yeah. One of the things that I find, Patrick, is as I engage with, let's just call them high capacity givers, with folks who have the ability to kind of lead the way in the donor efforts within your organization. As I spend more time with that group of people, one of the things that I consistently see is that these folks understand what they're good at, right? They are high achievers. They're successful in their business. Whatever that looks like for them, they recognize the space in which they operate and that they have a gifting and an ability to, let's just say, earn money, right? And yet there are other things that they care about. There are other things that they want to do in other spaces where they want to have influence and potentially make a difference. And so as a nonprofit, you come in and perhaps there's an alignment of that within what you are doing. And so when you begin to understand that, you're not asking for money for yourself, right? You're not, when I go as the representative of a nonprofit, I'm not asking for money for Mark. I mean, yeah, you can connect the dots, I suppose, at some point that you see that the operational budget is going to bring a salary to me or whatever that looks like, but that's not really what I'm asking about. I'm asking to align what they care about and the thing that we're doing in a way that we can both move forward in something that they care about and the mission that we're trying to accomplish. And together we can do great things. Yeah. And that's really what, I mean, that's fundraising, but I don't like to call it fundraising when we start talking to givers, right?
Yeah, but we can use that inside baseball language on this podcast. Yeah, no, I could not have framed that better. And one of the things that I've often, I learned this years ago when I was in organizational leadership, and it goes beyond just the funding part and the giving money part. It goes into the giving time part too. The volunteerism, for example, a board member, the pattern is that we need an accountant on our board, right? We need someone with financial expertise on our board. So let's call the accounting firm and ask this partner of this accounting firm to come on our board. Oh, and be our treasurer, by the way, because that's your skill set. Well, what I learned is that that's great. And it's good if you can have that. It's great intellectual capital and expertise, and you do want that. But maybe that particular CPA wants to do anything outside of his or her office except finance. Yep. Like, you know, I want an outlet where I can work on reading to kids, or where I can, you know, build a habitat home, or where I can, you know, roll my sleeves up and do some public policy work with the organization. I don't want to do finance. I do that all day, every day in my job. We make the assumption that, oh, you're a finance person, come be our treasurer. And they don't always want that. So I think what you've hit on is anyone we're engaging in our organizations, it's really about getting to know them, connecting their motivations, skills, and interests to the work that needs to be done back here. And we can't assume what those connections might be.
And that really is what it's about. It's about relationship. Ask questions and listen. Ask questions about what's interesting to them. Yeah. You know, hey, what are the things that we do that you think are pretty cool? What resonates with you? And they'll tell you, man, I think it's great what you do for kids after school or whatever that looks like for you guys. They'll tell you what they like. And then just take that conversation to the next place.
I learned that the hard way, Mark. I had early on in my United Way days, you know, I would be new in a community and I would go and meet with, you know, those high capacity, high potential investors or board members or community leaders or influencers. Mm-hmm. And because I have a strong point of view and I'm a pretty good storyteller and I can make a case and I'm persuasive and I can be dynamic and smart and all that stuff, I want to go in and talk to them and tell them all the great stuff we're doing and how we're going to be better than ever and you know, unique, powerful stories that really make you. And early on, it took a board member or two to pull me aside and say, man, you're really great. And they love this stuff. Let's just open a space and let's listen to them a little bit, you know, get out your notepad and ask them some questions and learn about what they want. And man, it was powerful learning for me. I mean, I make my living asking questions and listening. So I've had to do that. I've had to work on it. But early on, it was a pitfall for me. And I think it still is for a lot of people. We want to go tell our story before we listen to who are we even talking to here.
Yeah. And another thing I would encourage you to do as a leader of a nonprofit is in that listening space, ask about their story. Like, why is this important to you? Because here's another thing that's going to happen is that's going to give you more communication material for the next time that you talk to someone else.
Yeah.
Because now you'll begin to see where there's alignment. You'll see where people's heartbeat is connected to what you're doing. And it'll just refine your message and help you be better at communicating in the places where people are asking you to speak.
You have me thinking so many different things. One of the things we do a lot in strategic planning is stakeholder discovery. So if an organization is moving into strategic planning process or cycle, we want to hear from our donors. And on one hand, yeah, you do. You want to hear from them. Let's find a few and let's interview them or let's survey them or whatever. But if we're really doing what you're talking about, we don't need to pause during a strategic planning cycle and ask our donors what they think and feel and care about. We already know.
Yes.
We know that because we have ongoing conversations and relationships with them. And we don't have to do a survey because we're connected. We're in tune with what that is. So we're really saving a lot of time and formality if we really already know the answers to that. Mm-hmm. So if we go out with true curiosity, I love it. Let me shift real quick. I'm really interested. I know you touch on fundraising extensively with the organizations. You also do some leadership work, some executive coaching, some leadership coaching. Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Let me not leave the fundraising thing just yet though. One of the things that, that you talk about is thriving in economic challenges. Thriving financially during economic challenges. I'm hearing a lot. One of the things I ask our organizations as they think about the future is that we ask them to predict. What are some of your predictions for the next 1 to 3 to 5 years? And most of what we're hearing is some pessimism regarding where the economy will be at that point. There's a lot of fear about where this is going. Not a lot of hope of, oh man, 3 years from now, things are going to be so much better. We're going to be rocking it. There's a lot of, man, we're not sure where this is going. This could get tougher. It's already tough. Interest rates are rising and inflation, and we don't know where this is going and all the political turmoil in the markets, and we could be heading into a recession. What's that going to look like? That tends to be right now the mindset, the fear. It's sitting in the background, sort of messing with mindsets. What are the tenets that you're helping organizations think through to not just sit and be paralyzed by that notion, but literally not just survive it, but thrive in it? What are those tenets?
So let me go back a little bit to 2008, 2009. I live in an area that is heavily concentrated on manufacturing, and the main road in our town literally lost half of its tenants in 2009. there were empty buildings, and it was a hard place to be in, because it just really, it was very, very depressed because of what had happened in the economy. But I noticed a couple of things coming out of it. There were companies in the construction and trade space that went away. In other words, because of the housing shrinkage that happened in 2009, their companies were done. They were no longer working. Others had downsized, whatever, so on and so forth. There were then companies in that same space who, as I have talked to over the last 15 years, have said they've had the best 15 years ever, and like year after year after year growth. And so started doing some like inquiring of them, like, wait a minute, I thought everybody was hurting in that space coming out of 2008, 2009. And, you know, then they would each give me their answers on, well, this is what we did. This is how we were kind of prepared for it, but here's the pivots that we made in the midst of it. And there's a couple of things that are consistent about all of them that I would say are critical in this space. And that is, number one, they had to make a pivot. Number two, they were proactive. I tend to see nonprofit leaders who have a hesitancy to be what I'll call aggressive. I think sometimes we have this idea that churches, nonprofits, we should be kind of meek and mild and kind of only speak when spoken to, kind of this kind of mindset about what a nonprofit leader is or should be. And I would say to you, in order to thrive in what we'll call a economic downturn, although I have some thoughts about the reality of that here in a little bit, but is you need to be proactive, you need to pivot, and you need to be aggressive. Because here's what I would say to that is, if your nonprofit is worth it, then we got to go. We have to press in. We have to be aggressive. If your nonprofit is not worth it, then what are we doing?
What are we doing? Yeah.
What are we doing? Let's shut it down. So it's worth it. Get a plan. Make the pivots that you need to make, but be aggressive. And by being aggressive, I mean focusing on the places where you can increase donors. How do you capture new donors? And if you don't have that plan, well, let's have a conversation, because you need to have that plan. How do you retain the donors that you have? And then how do you tell the story about the impact that you're making? Because if you can't tell the story, others aren't going to tell it for you. You need to have that story out there. You need to elevate the difference that you're making. And every nonprofit I've ever interacted with has a story. They have a very compelling story to tell, and they are to varying degrees successful at telling that story.
I was listening to a video clip just recently that you just made me think of. It was the actor, the English actor, Michael Caine. I think he's English. And he was saying that when he was learning his trade in acting school, I guess, or maybe it was during an audition for something, but he said he was told to use the difficulty. Use the difficulty. So there was this scene. I'm probably going to get this wrong, but you'll get the gist of it. There's the scene he's either auditioning for, or they're running through it, and he's supposed to come into a room where maybe somebody's arguing, or there's some tense situation. And when he did it, there was a chair blocking the door that he was supposed to come into, and it wasn't supposed to be there. But as an actor, he's like, oh man, this is in the way. And he's like, oh, sorry, look, can we redo this or something like that? And the director goes, no, use the difficulty. He said, so if it's a comedy and there's a chair there, you know, use it. Make something funny about the fact that you can't get in because there's a chair there. If it's a drama, it's an action, it's a thriller, you know, kick the chair out of the way and do whatever you got to use the difficulty. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it really rang with me. This was probably just 3 nights ago, but what you're talking about, people who thrived during the pandemic used the difficulty, you know, I will tell you, you know, I launched my first online leadership coaching cohort because of, I mean, you know, I'm at home. I'm not doing in-site facilitations. My business dropped for a little while there. It picked up dramatically after, or even during. But in that first phase of, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? And everyone's panicking and we're not doing retreats right now. And we're not doing, you know, I launched the podcast. I launched the, my first online coaching cohort. And, that was what you're talking about in terms of pivoting and using the difficulty. There were nonprofits that blew fundraising out of the water during COVID because they used it.
Yes.
They connected their story with the global pandemic and the difficulty that is challenging in our country. Those that sat back and go, oh my God, what are we going to do? They struggled. And many of them are not operating today. So I appreciate that. I think that's the pivot. And it's easy to say too, when you talk about the business world, how many of those businesses that, so for example, you talked about the people that shut down on the street there in your town because of COVID. Well, some businesses, I mean, a global pandemic and an economic shutdown. You're done, I guess. Other businesses are more conducive to pivoting and it's easier for them based on the, you know, I mean, look at what DoorDash did, you know, during the pandemic. So some of it is the kind of business and organization you're in, but I would say more of it has to be whatever it is. You're just going to have to get creative.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the reality of what this economic downturn is.
Yeah. I'm curious to know your perspective on that.
So there, no doubt there are segments of our economy that are, let's say, struggling, being impacted by whatever is happening about our economy right now. But I would say to you that there are several indicators that, as a non-economist, I am not an economist, I am not a Wall Street guy, I'm not watching it every hour, every moment, but here's what I see, okay? What I see is housing prices are not coming down. They're staying the same and houses are selling. Lots of people are going on vacation. They are not, you are not getting in the way of my summer trip to whatever it is. I'm going to the beach. I'm going to see Mickey Mouse, whatever that is. They're going. Car lots are still not at capacity. They can't find inventory. So people are buying cars.
Expensive cars.
Very expensive cars. And so I recognize interest rates are going up. That impacts each and every one of us. I get that. There is a lot of fear that's out there about the economy. And what I would say to you is, if you, as a nonprofit leader, if you kind of capsize into that fear, what's going to happen is you're going to communicate from a place of fear. You're going to talk to donors from a place of fear. You're going to lead your team and your board from a place of fear. And frankly, just on an emotional perspective, that's not attractive. That's not something people want to be engaged with. So just for the pure ability for you to lead in the best possible way, you need to pull out of that fear. You need to pull out of that into a place of, because of this fear, we need to continue to bring the light and hope that we have to make a difference.
That's well said. And I know that resonates in the church world, because there's a lot of spiritual concept behind that whole notion. But I think what you're saying is we have to be vigilant and prepare, but not operate from a place of fear.
Yes. Yes. Big difference. Let's just talk a little bit about like what's happening to income levels of the people around us. Okay. So we often talk about, you know, in very broad terms, lower class, middle class, upper class, whatever that looks like, right? What I'm seeing is the upper class is growing, the lower class is growing, the middle class is shrinking.
Yeah.
All the more reason you need to be in tune with your high capacity givers if you're a nonprofit, because they are the fuel that helps you accomplish more. And You have to have a relationship with them. You have to connect with them. You have to be telling your story. And again, if you're telling that story from a place of fear, I'm not sure I want to invest in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me, I'm interested, Mark, in speed. How are you helping nonprofits increase their speed? If you look at our website and you go to our mission page, you'll see our construct, and one of our underlying purposes for existing is the snail pace of movement in the sector. And it's by design, and it's by way of culture and constraints that we've put on ourselves and how we think the nonprofit sector is supposed to operate. You know, we have to get everybody on board. The board has to approve things. You got to have committees. The stakeholders have to agree. You can't go too fast for your community. And I get all that. And by the way, social change takes a long time to accomplish.
Yes.
But the sector moves, much of the sector moves excruciatingly slow. Mm-hmm. And I'm coaching a lot of leaders who say, man, I go back at the minutes we took in 1965. And they're having some of the same conversations we're still having, and we haven't done any, we haven't moved off dead center on it. It was same stuff. So the energy comes only from the conversations, and yet we haven't really moved on it. Yeah. What are some of the, and again, just looking for maybe two or three of the tenets or the principal points that you help nonprofits think about to increase their speed without sacrificing, in fact, without sacrificing impact, but in fact, to create even greater impact.
Yeah. There's a lot of research around the neuroscience of early adopters, late adopters. So I can't take credit for this. I have from a couple of different sources began to understand a little bit more about early adopters, late adopters.
Yep.
And in a book by Charles Duhigg, and we'll get the name of that and put it in the links perhaps so that we can give attribution to the right author here. A book by Charles Duhigg, where he talks about this idea of companies that move fast, organizations that move fast, organizations that move slow. And how do early adopters and late adopters respond in the midst of, you know, an organization that moves fast or an organization that moves slow? And so they had all sorts of metrics and kind of case studies as to what qualifies as moving fast or moving slow and all those sort of things. So you can dig into that if that's helpful to you. But here's the takeaway on it. Regardless of whether or not the organization moved fast or moved slow based on the criteria that they gave, late adopters were still late adopters. In fact, slowing down did not increase the response rate or the affirmation of late adopters. All it did when the organization slowed down is it just slowed down the late adopters.
Just took longer. Same cycle.
Yes, right. And the organization moved fast, still had the same proportion of late adopters. It didn't really push them away as much as they were just still behind at the same pace. But where the difference is in the early adopters. The organization that moved slow lost early adopters.
That was just heading there in my head. That's a great framing and
the
research
organization
behind
that moved fast ignited the fire in them, and the early adopters were their champions, and they were the ones spreading the word and bringing more people into that space. Mm.
That makes
sense. So yes, we honor
sense.
Our community. We don't run over people, all those sorts of things. But my sense is most churches and nonprofits are moving slower than they need to move. And it's costing them early adopters because of it.
All right, everybody, pause your podcast, rewind 10 seconds, and listen to that three times. That most nonprofits are moving slower than they need to. And it isn't because we don't care and we don't want to move fast and we're indifferent or we're you know, it is that we think we are constrained. It's like,
yes.
You know, it's cliche and it's an old adage, but the elephant that's tied down with just a thread because they've been conditioned that if there's something there, I watched a video the other day, and this is another, people are going to think, man, what do? You sit and watch YouTube reels all day? But I did, I saw a video of a horse trainer who made the motion. There was no bridle, made a motion of putting the bridle on the horse.
Mm.
And grabbed the rope and did like this, and everything's invisible. and the horse walked along as if they were being pulled by a rope. There was no rope there, just the trainer doing the motion of it and touching the horse's head and making it do, you know, that same that the horse has been conditioned to know. I know what those motions are. I know what's happening right now.
Wow.
And that trainer led that horse across the field on an invisible rope. And I think we are on that invisible rope as a sector. I really do. I think that's what you're saying. These some of the constraints we think are there, they're not if we just go.
I think I also want to lean into another space where I think the nonprofit leader is facing, and that is the fact that they care deeply about the people they are leading. They care deeply about their board. They have high relationship, and they want to make sure that they, I don't know if it's default to consensus, but I think they care. Yeah. And that's admirable. That's what we want. Absolutely. We want people who care, who have empathy and that sort of thing, but not at the sake of keeping your organization from like moving ahead. And sometimes it's careful questioning that your board is bringing in. It's not to say that they're trying to keep you from doing anything. They're just asking good questions because they care. And that's not to be dismissed, but yes, in large part, most nonprofit and churches are operating much slower than they need to because of the couple of things that we've highlighted here.
I couldn't agree more. And the challenges are real. You know, this is not an indictment on anybody's effort or their reality. I mean, they're facing complex work.
Yes.
And many would say they have the hardest job in the world, you know, more than, you know, neurosurgery or rocket science. So,
yes.
I hope our listeners aren't hearing this as an insult, but rather as an encouragement.
Yes.
That there are things that we can do. And I also find, you know, I do a lot of board retreats, and it's interesting to me how often I hear the appetite from the board when you ask them the right questions in a way that surprises their executive director. Because their executive director has been operating under some notion or assumption or inference that their board doesn't want, you know, our board just not, you know, doesn't have an appetite for speed or boldness or innovation. Yeah. And yet when you meet with the board and you dig in and you ask the right questions, the appetite actually is there and they are wanting to move forward. They just don't know how.
Right.
So that inability to know how feels like we don't want to, or we shouldn't. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's not a matter of appetite and motivation.
Yeah.
So I also mentioned, your material says, and I loved this. I think maybe the best way to talk about this would maybe if you've got a story or two, I don't know, but when you say helping nonprofits pursue crazy goals, mm-hmm. is another thing that exists in the sector is a huge risk aversion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have these bright ideas and then everybody goes, okay, but now let's come back to earth. You know, let's get real here. What do we mean by crazy goals, and how are you helping teams push beyond, you know, only doing what they know they can do and that makes perfect sense to everybody versus let's get out of the box and let's innovate.
There is there is an attribute of high capacity givers that pretty early on I will reinforce with organizations I work with. The high capacity givers do not want to be alone. In other words, they don't want to be the only donor that helps you accomplish your budget or your goal or your project. They want to know that they're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is,
by the way, real quickly, foundations also don't want that.
That's right.
They don't want to be your only grant. They don't want you to say, we're doing this program, but only if we get your money. If we don't, well, we're just not going to be able to do it. Foundations Yes. want organizations that are going to do what they're going to do with or without that grant, but that their grant adds leverage and multiplier effect. So it's not just individuals. Exactly. That's true about an increasing number of foundations as well. Sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to throw
that. Yeah, no, that's great. That's the reinforcement there. And the second thing is they want to do something that would not get done ordinarily on its own.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the operational budget I mean, yeah, they want you to be able to survive, but they want to, I don't know if wowed is the right word, but high capacity givers want to get to something that is actually like big. That's a big deal. And I mean, if they are thinking they have the ability to give, let's just talk big numbers here for effect. If they're thinking they want to give 2 million, 3 million, $4 million to nonprofits over the course of the year, and you are trying to bring an idea to them that is, man, if we had $500,000, we could do this and this and this. And they're thinking, yeah, you can do that with, 20 other people. You don't really need me. Even though they could fund the whole thing, and you know that, and you're thinking, well, like, what's the deal? You need to have something that attracts that caliber of a giver. And so the way that I would almost reverse engineer it, you need to have a relationship with your high capacity givers so that they can help inform your goals. Because they may come in and say, yeah, that's good, but what if we did this? I mean, think about it. These guys are high achievers. These gals get things done on a daily basis. So they're going to think big. They will help you think big. And in many ways, you will be surprised by what they perceive as possible for your organization.
So
Now, all of
good.
a sudden, you've got their energy, their wind behind these sails, and here we go.
Absolutely. I had a one of these high capacity donors in a community years ago that I was new, and I'm telling the story, and we're asking for a big gift from this individual who had, been in the community, a staple, a pillar actually in the community. And I'll never forget this. I told this story yesterday to a group because it was a pivot point for my mindset and the way I approach things. We went through the pitch and the conversation, and he was pleasant enough, and but he kind of looked over his glasses at me, and he said, "Patrick, I don't hate your organization. I love your organization. I've just bought all I want to buy from you." And that was his phrase. And it hit me. I mean, this is an individual now who's supporting, statewide public-private partnerships and big, grant match things for innovative things. And I'm like, yeah, we haven't done anything innovative in a long time. And this guy doesn't just want to, pour his philanthropy into this perpetual state of maintaining. And that really resonated with me. This is someone who's on to the next thing. I'm on to the next thing. And so we have to have that next thing in our organizations. And it doesn't mean we go off mission. It just means we have a next thing to help us achieve our mission, because what got us here won't get us there. And the donors know that.
And so when I speak to kind of this idea of reverse engineering, what I mean is getting some grassroots input into what your vision could and should accomplish. Because then once you have that kind of grassroots momentum behind it, it's not going to be crazy in the sense of like when we're done, we're not going to be even halfway there because your people have spoken into it. But it's crazy in the sense of like, wow, I didn't know that we would be able to do that, or that that would be the thing that the energy has come behind. Wow, this is cool. Let's do this. And sometimes that's the crazy effect behind it. That's the ability to accomplish something that kind of in your own little bubble you think up and dream, and then you're like, oh, someone else thinks that that's not really that big of a deal. And It's almost like a trial run on your vision. Like bring your vision to that grassroots conversation with your high capacity givers, and they will feed into it. They care about you. They care about what you're doing. But in order to go to the next step, you've got to have a big goal out there, and that's why it's important.
I love that phrase, a trial run on your vision. In other words, test it. You know, like from time to time, you got to test that vision. You know, is there anybody out there, you know, kind of thing, anybody with us here? Because it has to be a shared vision in some degree. Certainly your donors have to share in that. I've got we have a YouTube channel, and I do these little 5-minute sort of coaching videos and things. And I've got an upcoming video on reverse engineering, Mark. And the way that I think about it is magic, magicians. I knew a really, really, really amazing sort of street magician, kind of the close up, you know, in your face, sleight of hand kind of stuff. And this was in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I'm visiting with him in his office. It was actually a meeting about United Way. This guy was so creative. He was a musician and a magician and a film producer, all these things. But he did this amazing, like blew my mind with this card trick sitting there in his office. And I got to talking about, you know, how do you come up with this stuff? He says, it's real simple. Magicians think, hey, what would be impossible and blow somebody's mind? How would I go about making it look like that happened? And you literally, you know, so what would it blow your mind? For example, if you looked up and there was, you know, your card was on the ceiling, you know, that would be a cool, amazing effect. How would I make it appear that that's happened? Now, of course, in magic, it's not magic, right? Yeah, it's you figured out a way to create the same effect that magic has.
Wow.
And you entertained somebody and you moved them and you added value to their life. Cause who doesn't like a good magic trick? But it's all about reverse engineering, thinking about what is seemingly or to most people impossible. And then going, well, what would it take? Let's back up from that. What would it take to make that happen?
And I
think that's what you're talking about, except what we're trying to create are not illusions. We're trying to create real stuff. Let me shift again here. Mario, let me just talk about leadership, fundraising. Boy, we could spend the next 10 podcast episodes and not get there, right? But you do some leadership work as well. And I'm always interested in talking with other coaches. I'm in this space, but what are some of the common, what are some of the biggest or common challenges that you see keep coming up for nonprofit leaders in this space? What do you find yourself mostly coaching around?
I would say, I'm having the most conversations around this idea of, staff retention. How do I keep, keep my best players?
Or even staff acquisition. I mean, that one's a big one for me right now too. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Succession. I'm dealing with a lot of leaders who are thinking about their last years and organizations who are saying like, hey, we love him. He's great, but he's not going to be here forever. What do we do?
Ditto.
So I do some coaching through succession.
Ditto. Quick interjection there. We did a compensation study here in our state recently, and I think the number was around 2/3 of nonprofit CEOs in our state will be retiring within the next 5 years.
Wow.
It's a big number, whatever. I think that's about right. I mean, it was a shot. I was like, whoa. And so developing the pipeline right now is a big deal in our state. I don't know if it's that way everywhere, but yeah. Boomers are
one organization that I'm working with, coaching them through succession. We're putting together a 10-year plan because they're that concerned about it. And, they don't want this to be just a 10 years of like ramping him out as much as we still want to grow during these 10 years. Mm-hmm. We still want to create greater impact, but we want to honor him and his trajectory as he goes out. And we want to elevate our next leader going in. So that's why we're taking so much time to build out this plan.
Wow. What are you finding in this staff retention and acquisition space as best practices or solutions or positive stories? I know, how are the good nonprofits doing it from your view?
The number one job of a leader is to communicate. And I think we've come through the pandemic and a lot of leaders, their heads are scrambled. I don't really know how to succinctly say it. I think there's a lot of leaders who are confused about how they did work pre-pandemic, how they're supposed to do work now.
Disoriented.
What do I have time for? Mm-hmm. What's that?
Disoriented.
disoriented. There's a fog, there's a haze, there's all this stuff kind of going on. Now I've got to do all these things online and I can't be face to face. And that's how I came into this work. And it's just a complete paradigm shift in how they have to work. So everything is scrambled in their brain and a leader is just saying, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. And yet he's not communicating well with his team. And so then the team is like, well, it just feels like nobody knows what's going on around here. We don't know what we're doing and we don't have any kind of big goals. We're just kind of limping along. Man, this feels like it's a little shaky. The economy is doing this. And you see the snowball effect that's happening here.
And that's also what brings fear in.
Yes.
Because the unknown will scare somebody more than anything. And if the speaker's not speaking, people are left questioning and creating their own narratives and the fear slips into your culture.
And so what happens to a staff member who feels a little bit of uncertainty, who feels this whole fear thing going on around them, the thing that brought them into your organization was the mission, the thing that you're accomplishing, the problem you're solving, the people you're helping. That's why they're here. And if we're not doing that to the ability that we can, wow, maybe this isn't what I thought it would be. If I go over here, I can make 50% more. If this isn't going to go, maybe I should go.
Well, it's the old saying, people join organizations and they leave their managers.
Yeah.
So yeah, they join for the mission and the right reasons. The mission's not what makes them leave.
Yes.
The lack of leadership or poor leadership is what makes them leave.
Yes. And so I'll come back to kind of how I started this point. And that is, if you're the leader, your number one job is to communicate. And that's two way, you know, be authentic, be transparent. Hey, I'm struggling. This is still the most important thing that we're doing. I feel like we're not able to accomplish it as good as we did previously or whatever it looks like. Just be authentic. Mm-hmm. Let them speak into it. Let them collaborate with you. Let them be transparent with you and you'll earn trust. And so as a leader, your number one job is to communicate with your team.
That's good. And while you're expressing that vulnerability and throwing out, you know, the reality on the table in a transparent way, the other thing, and this is where the coaching model comes in. If you're unsure and you're telling them you're unsure, that's fine, but then invite their best thinking and draw it out. What ideas, you know, what are you thinking about this? How what would help you move forward? What would help us move forward? How can I help you move forward? What do you need in order to get it? So I think that asking, drawing out of them, giving that deference, it extends autonomy to them actually, because they now feel like they have some decision-making influence of some sort, even if it's just their say in the matter. So I love that. That's a coaching tenet. Let me shift to a couple of questions, Mark, that I ask all my guests, and we'll wind this down. This has been great. I appreciate the generosity of content here. This is just, I mean, you've given me some really good stuff. I'm going to steal several things, just so you know. who's a leader in your life, Mark, that comes to mind, you know, every time or immediately when you think about, man, this leader had profound impact on my view of leadership? And not just, you know, how I got to where I am today, but my point of view on leadership and how that has shaped me. Who comes to mind and why?
So the first one would be a person that I've never met, but I've benefited greatly from his work. And that's John Maxwell.
Oh, absolutely.
Me too. I think he was the first person that I heard talk about leadership in a very different light than anyone else that I had heard that I had exposure to. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose part of that was, you know, just the circle of people that I was connected with and whatever, that's the conference we went to, so on and so forth. But John Maxwell's leadership and the books that he's written, in my opinion, for me, and at that stage of my life, really put leadership at a place where I felt like I could grab a hold of it. And it became something that I aspired to and really helped me grow in my own personal development.
I'm with you on that. He, you know, I don't know that he would, we could say he's the first person to come up with it, but I think he really amplified the message that leadership and authority are not synonymous.
Yes.
And that leadership is influence, not manipulation. And so he framed it in such a way, and just, you know, of course his brand, his market, his success did that. So if he didn't really sort of frame that thought, he certainly elevated it and framed it in a way that had tremendous and widespread impact. I think there's a lot of people today who say that and don't realize they probably got it from John Maxwell, or somebody who got it from John Maxwell. So I think you're right about that. Anybody else come to mind?
So there have been a lot of individual friends and people I've been connected with along my journey that I would say were in my life at just the right time and spoke the right words to me at just the right time that were like, wow, okay. And I remember one conversation specifically with during a time where I was running a soccer league, oddly enough. I was director of a soccer league and talking to one of my coaches, and we were just kind of talking about some of the future that each of us kind of had in mind. And I told him about one thing, and I said, you know, I kind of think I would like to do this. I'd like to explore this. And he looked at me and he said, dude, you can totally do that. I could totally see that. And he just went down the line of like, here's what you have this, and you have this, and you have this, and you can totally do that. And I just looked back at him like, yeah, I can. And I just thought, you know, how powerful that was for Dave to, you know, just kind of like, dude, you can do this. There have been several of those moments in my life that I can speak to. And, you know, there was a conversation with one of my friends, Justin, and there was a conversation with one of my friends, Kevin. And I would just say they, at just the right time, gave me a great impact and great influence on what I did next because of what they saw in me. And I would just say those people are out there. And if you don't have conversations with anybody, you'll never hear someone say those kinds of things. And so it just is a continual reminder to me to talk to other people, invest in other people, and allow other people to invest back into you.
Oh, that's good. And when you said those people are out there, immediately what hit my head was, yeah, and we are them. Like, how do we pay that forward, and realizing that absolutely, the moments we have with our team members, we don't know the impact we're having by one simple statement. You know, him saying that out loud, that you could do that.
Yeah.
It wasn't any big revelation of new information. It's just that person saying it out loud meant something to you. And that's a good reminder for us to keep that moving forward. I'm going to ask you one more question, because this is just, again, this has been fantastic. I want to thank you, but I want to ask you, if you had a megaphone and you had a mountaintop and all of the leaders of the world were underneath, down in the valley listening to you, and you had 15 to 20 seconds to say, this is the most important thing that all leaders need to always keep in mind and keep at the forefront, what would that be? What's the Mark Slaybaugh, number one tenet of leadership?
It's a math equation. Ooh. And it's this: trust plus motivation equals a better team. Build trust, earn trust, listen to your people, because then they will tell you what motivates them and what's important to them. And when you have that trust, when you understand what motivates them, you will have a better team.
Man, you just don't know how aligned that is. We say all the time, leaders don't motivate people. It's not what we do. We connect people's existing motivations, their intrinsic internal drivers, to the work that needs to be done in a way that's fulfilling for them and achieves what we need to achieve. Man, that was so, so well said. I appreciate it. Give us the website is it Slaybaugh.com, Slaybaugh Coaching.com? What's the website?
Yeah, Slaybaugh Coaching.com. Okay. And let's put a /jinx after that, and I'll have a couple of resources for your audience. So again, that's Slaybaugh Coaching.com/jinx. And there'll be a couple of things that you can grab there. One is there's a baseline assessment for your team. It's essentially awesome. Just like 25 questions for your team to answer 1 through 5, you know, agree, disagree, you know, that kind of a thing. And then just have a conversation around it. Well, I had a 1, you had a 5. Why do we have a difference there? And it's just a conversation starter. So download that team assessment, That'll be a great conversation tool for your team. I do have a podcast called Career Chaos, where I talk about careers and transitions. And so you get, there's a link there for your people to, if they want to hear some thoughts around careers and transitions, they can engage in that. And if they want to have a conversation with me, there's a button right there that gets you to my calendar, and you can schedule a time. If you're struggling with fundraising, if you're struggling with a succession conversation or getting ready to start one of those conversations, I'm here to help you, and I'd love to help your team.
What a great resource. And thanks for the Jinx page on that and those resources. That great offering. By the way, folks, Slaybaugh, we'll have it, of course, on our podcast page. But if you're listening to this on, you know, Apple or one of the others, Slaybaugh is Slaybaugh. Slaybaughcoaching.com/Jinx. So again, Mark, this has been great. Thank you. And we'll stay in touch, and lead on, folks.